It is Thursday, August 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Defense Secretary says sanctions against Moscow will remain until Russia changes its behavior. Yemen's former president draws a large crowd to mark the founding of his party, and a fashion entrepreneur transports her boutique to her customers. It's all ahead. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said Thursday during a visit to Ukraine that Russia is seeking to withdraw international borders by force. He also said that U.S. sanctions against Russia will remain in place until the government in Moscow changes its behavior. Mattis spoke alongside Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko after a meeting in Kiev. I spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb about Mattis's comments.
Secretary Mattis said that the United States will not accept Russia's seizure of Crimea, and he also said that despite Russia's denials, the United States knows that they are seeking to redraw these borders, as you said. He said it was undermining the free and sovereign nations of Europe, and he vowed that the United States would support Ukraine in this. Now, when you talk about supporting Ukraine, there are lots of ways you can support Ukraine, and one of those ways that has been circling around here is the possibility of providing lethal weapons to Ukrainian forces. The secretary was asked, would the United States do this? President Obama did not and chose not to, but Secretary Mattis said that the United States was actively reviewing that possibility, and now that he has been to Ukraine and seen the current situation, he can inform the president with very specific terms for the direction ahead.
Did Ukrainian President Poroshenko have any comments about Mr. Mattis's remarks?
Well, the Ukrainians in general have wanted more and more support with even lethal weapons. The problem with it on the United States side, however, is that there are two camps, essentially. There's the one camp that feels like it is morally right to provide Ukrainians with the tools that they need to support themselves and protect themselves from what is clearly determined by many is Russian aggression. There is another camp, however, that acknowledges this point, but then worries that providing such weapons would provoke Russia and escalate the conflict further, causing even more Ukrainians to die. So it puts the United States in a very difficult position. And so whereas President Obama said, okay, it's going to be counterproductive if more people die, we're not exactly clear on what President Trump will decide to do and how he will interpret it. And I think that President Poroshenko is just trying to do as much as he can to cultivate the United States relationship to get more aid.
Well, in other Pentagon news, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the White House is going to be giving the Pentagon guidance on implementing President Trump's order to ban transgender people serving in the military. What have Defense Department officials said about this today?
I actually just got off the phone with another official who said that the Pentagon has not received any guidance. They have heard of the so-called memos, but nothing has actually trickled down to the Pentagon. And until they get that guidance, there is no change to the Pentagon's current policy. I know that the White House has said that there are tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgenders in the military cause. There are others. There's a petition going out that I've been told about with more than 200,000 signatures since this Trump tweet came out saying that it does not do so and that the majority of transgenders in the military do not undergo the surgery that Trump is tweeting about that costs so much money. So there's clearly a lot of arguments going on, and I think the focus of this that Trump tweeted on would be on the deployability of the troops. If you are transgender, but you can deploy just like any other service member, there should not be any reason for you not serving in the military. I don't think that Secretary Mattis would be for that. So we're going to have to see in the coming days, after the memo turns into actual recommendations to the Pentagon, what is going to come out of this.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, that petition that Carla just mentioned spreading around social media, and with the news about this memo coming forward, there's a renewed sense of action on social media, with a lot of activists using Twitter and Facebook and other means to try to galvanize support for their side and against this ban that's trying to go forward. So that's something that we've seen ever since this was announced. And again, now with this memo news, it has a renewed sense, and it's happening again. We're also seeing a lot of activity around President Trump's tweets. But then again, what day do we have that isn't activity on Twitter for President Trump? This time he's facing off against some of his Republican fellow Republicans, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, going after James Clapper, who is a former intelligence chief. And of course, the fake news, which is always a perpetual talking point for President Trump on Twitter. He's also retweeted a photo posted by one of his supporters that shows President Trump slowly moving in front of President Obama, and this person called it the best eclipse ever. That got a lot of attention because, as many people pointed out, eclipses are only temporary, and something that Trump moving in front of Obama is like the moon covering up the sun and creating darkness. However, Trump supporters really liked this. They thought it was quite funny. So it's more of that what we call red meat for the base, that kind of stuff to stoke his supporters. The other big name that we're seeing trending today is Christopher Cantwell. He was the organizer of the torch-lit white supremacist march in Charlottesville, Virginia. He's turned himself into police. He was dubbed the crying Nazi or the weeping Nazi because after that rally, he posted a video online that went all over social media where he talked about his fear of being arrested or harmed, where he was in tears and crying. Well, now he is in prison. Social media amazed that he has turned himself into the victim in this, but they're also glad to see that he is in police custody.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Angola's ruling party claims victory in the country's recent election. President Trump blames Republican congressional leaders for creating a debt ceiling mess. President Trump's aide and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, renews a push for Middle East peace. And Pakistan tells the U.S. to eliminate terror safe havens in Afghanistan. Expanded coverage in these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study suggests that our Milky Way galaxy could be home to between 25 and 100 billion brown dwarfs. A brown dwarf is a celestial object with a mass somewhere between a star and a planet. A brown dwarf was supposed to become a star, but sometime during its formation was unable to gain enough mass that it could sustain the needed hydrogen fusion at its core to actually become a full-fledged star. The researchers focused their search within several dense star clusters, which are groups of stars that are gravitationally bound to each other. They found 5 brown dwarfs for every 10 stars in one of the clusters. To see if this was an unusual proportion, they checked another, more distant cluster and found the same ratio of brown dwarfs to stars. The researchers presented their findings at the recently concluded National Astronomy Meeting in the UK. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. We'll hear how the terrain of Texas complicates the Trump border wall debate. Former Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh rallied thousands of his supporters Thursday in the capital Sana'a to mark the 35th anniversary of the founding of his General People's Congress Party. The show of support follows a recent rift with his Houthi rebel allies. Friction with the Houthis threatens to tear apart the alliance that has been battling forces loyal to exiled President Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi and a Saudi-led coalition. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The gathering of support for former President Saleh took place peacefully in Sana'a's Miden Sabain Square, despite recent tension between the veteran leader's party and his Houthi rebel allies, who remain the most powerful military force in Yemen. Saleh alluded to putting the thousands of military men still loyal to him into the conflict that has racked the country since the Houthis arrested internationally backed President Abdrabbu Mansour Hadi in 2015, eventually forcing him to flee. The Houthis have been battling a Saudi-led coalition that intervened in March 2015 to support Hadi. Yemen analyst Hakim al-Masmari tells VOA that Thursday's rally failed to change the political equation in the country, and the Houthis continue to hold the advantage for the next round of political dialogue, scheduled for September under the auspices of the United Nations. Saleh, nevertheless, he believes, remains a force to be reckoned with in the country.
He is the most powerful person in the country when it comes to social support. But when it comes to power on the ground, military power, the Houthis are the most powerful. Militarily, he is very far behind the Houthis.
A recent disagreement between Saleh and the Houthis erupted after the former president referred to the Houthis as a two-bit militia. But in his address to supporters Thursday, he directed most of his criticism to President Hadi and his Saudi allies. Saleh says his own supporters have made many sacrifices to defend the revolution that brought him to power in 1978 in what was then North Yemen. He says the ongoing war is tearing the country apart, blaming what he calls the traitorous and treacherous leadership under Hadi outside the country. The Houthi militia avoided a potential conflict with the former president and his supporters, despite talk in the media of declaring a state of emergency and forbidding political rallies like the one Thursday. A speech by Houthi leader Abdel Malik al-Houthi to his supporters earlier this week, in which he criticized Saleh, suggested a potential conflict was brewing between the two men. He says his forces have been stabbed in the back by their allies, despite the many sacrifices they have made at a time when they are fighting to stop the enemy aggression. Political alliances in Yemen are fickle, and Saleh's forces have fought the Houthi rebels six times since 2004, before forming an alliance after he fell out with his one-time deputy, Hadi. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
President Donald Trump's promised U.S.-Mexico border wall will likely trigger a budget showdown when Congress returns in September, as Democrats and some Republicans debate whether to start building the wall is worth the $1.6 billion expense. The wall is 2,700 kilometers away from Capitol Hill in the varied border terrain of Del Rio, Texas. Yet law enforcement and residents alike say the issue is even more complicated than Washington knows. VOA's congressional reporter Catherine Gibson followed the U.S. Border Patrol to learn more.
The Rio Grande, a river split between two countries.
It's very simple to get to the river on the Mexican side. It's very shallow.
Corey Maddox has watched undocumented immigrants try every way possible to cross it.
They'll use rafts, they'll use horses, inner tubes, and they'll just swim.
Most led by smugglers beating well-worn paths down to the river.
These guys, they've been doing this for a long, long time. The smugglers in the local area, they know the places across.
Border Patrol watches from the high bluffs above, but the thick carrizo cane below is treacherous, trapping heat and choking land up to the 3 kilometers of existing fence.
It can be creepy at night, you know, because you don't know the person you're trying to arrest.
The Rio Grande River separating the U.S. from Mexico is just one of the areas Border Patrol agents go into. They also track drug smugglers in the high desert and perform search and rescue missions in the canyons here surrounding the Pecos River. Canyons and burning desert that work as well as any wall.
It's not a one-size-fits-all border. And what is that right mix in one area may not be the right mix even a short distance away.
Matthew Hudak says the problem of border security can't be solved with a simple fix.
And even with infrastructure, it's still going to be a personnel-intensive area to patrol.
fencing works well in urban areas, but out in the desert.
And it takes a trained eye, it takes years to learn that craft.
Human eyes and ears work best.
It's not easy work. This is one of the most difficult areas in our area in order to track people.
It's the terrain that changes the debate about a continuous wall, says local law enforcement.
In my county, I don't think that we need to board a wall.
Sheriff Joe Frank Martinez says there's no danger here and that President Trump would find a different reality in person.
People need to step foot on the border. People that are talking need to know what they're talking about.
And some Del Rio residents believe Trump does understand that reality.
If the guy has got enough sense to make a $9 billion empire to build a building in downtown New York, he's got enough sense where to build a wall.
Even though Trump's promise of building a continuous wall is still up for debate back in Washington. Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Del Rio, Texas.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Danelle Johnson started designing her own clothes when she was a teenager. Not just because sewing was her hobby. She wanted to stand out among her classmates with a personal, distinctive look. Johnson's vision of fashion motivated her to start her own design company, On Wheels. As Faiza Almazri reports, the fashion entrepreneur attracts customers who prefer her rolling retail boutique to big malls and online shopping. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Danelle Johnson has always dreamed of having a boutique where she sells women's clothing and accessories. After graduating from the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising, she worked in Los Angeles, where fashion trucks are popular. That inspired her to return to her home state of Virginia and, this year, start a fashion business.
The theme is we are tiny, but we dream big. A lot of people thought I was crazy, but now that they see the vision, they totally understand it.
The vision is of a modern glass and steel one-room cottage, offering a very different experience than a store in the mall.
Everywhere I go and they see the tiny house, people want to know, what is that? And once they see, oh, wow, and you have a boutique, they automatically think it's amazing.
As amazing as it is, there are challenges, starting with driving to locations around Woodbridge, Virginia.
The biggest thing, of course, is pulling a trailer. I've never had to pull a trailer until I decided to do this, as well as the power and electricity. Since I'm mobile, I have to find a way to power everything in here to make it comfortable for everyone. Also securing things. When I'm moving and driving down the street, I have to secure all of the clothing, secure the mirror to make sure nothing falls and nothing breaks.
Johnson decorated the interior of her shop to be a welcoming, homey environment. Floor-to-ceiling glass windows on two sides let in natural light, which helps brighten the small space where she displays her wares. Hand-picked designs hang attractively from two garment racks attached to the wall. There's a full-length mirror and a fitting room. A comfortable bench gives customers a place to sit and also provides storage for more merchandise. Johnson gets the clothing she offers from different places, and says that makes her collection unique.
All of the clothes are made in the U.S., so a lot of the clothes are from the West Coast, California. I like to do a lot of research on different clothing. I also design clothes, so I'm also going to have local designers design for me.
What's the sizes by small, medium, large, mm-hmm. So what would they go by?
Alicia Jones, a social worker and mother of two, learned about Johnson through a friend on Facebook. She's now a repeat customer.
First of all, Danielle's is super personal, so I love that part about it. But also, I mean, if you look at the clothes, it's not things that you find just by going to a store or anything like that. I see some things online, but you never know how it's going to fit, especially me being short. I mean, things are going to be taller than I am. So it was really nice to be able to have like a boutique flair and be able to actually go and see how it fits on me.
Dominique Ariel Duncan modeled her friend's designs at the Tiny House of Fashion's grand opening fashion show in June and is happy that Johnson's business is doing well.
So I think she's already doing a great job with expanding, finding different locations to set up. So as long as she keeps doing that, she's on the right track.
Johnson is excited about the feedback she's gotten and sees the potential to expand.
Actually, the beauty about being mobile is I can come to customers. So if a bunch of girls are getting together for girls' night, or if an office wants me to come there during lunch or anything like that, I'm mobile, so it's very, very easy for me to do that.
Danielle Johnson has the support of her family and friends. They're spreading the word about her business on social media and with music.
And we wrote a jingle for Tiny House of Fashion.
One of her friends is a professional singer and wrote a theme song for the Tiny House of Fashion. For writer Faiza El Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
What I need, I got it. We are tiny, but we dream big.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and/or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303. USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.